as I mentioned, the weather in Ireland is very changeable, and really the best way to view or track those changes is by having observations that are constantly looking at the weather and at these weather systems, and really satellite data is the best mechanism for doing this. I certainly think AI will play a major role for all the reasons that I just mentioned. I think our short-term forecasts will become more accurate. So in other words, maybe, you know, a week or so, we will be able to be more specific on location and timing of weather events. And that will be very useful.
Hello, and welcome to the next episode of Watching Our Earth. I'm your host today, Dr. Hayley Evers-King, taking over in a special episode from your usual host, my colleague Mark Higgins. I'm one of the strange people who works with UMetSat who actually has not much to do with the weather. So I'm very excited today to talk to one of our users who has a lot to do with the weather. So it's my pleasure to introduce Noel Fitzpatrick from Met Aaron. Hi, Noel. How are you doing today?
Hi, Hayley. Very good. Glad to be here.
So let's jump straight into our podcast. Can you tell me a bit about what your role is at Met Aaron?
Sure thing. So my role is the satellite meteorologist for Met Aaron. So there's a fairly broad range of duties within that, but primarily I'm looking to increase the amount of satellite data and products that we use on a daily basis. So that also includes looking at opportunities to collaborate with our partners in, say, UMetSat or other weather agencies. And I also represent Met Aaron and Ireland at some of the delegate bodies that UMetSat has, such as the Scientific and Technical Group. At the moment, one of the big duties that I have is getting ourselves ready for the next generation of satellites and the stream of data that will be coming from them. So that's most of my role. I have some other roles in Met Aaron. In particular, I also present the Met Aaron podcast.
Ah, fantastic. So you're particularly well situated to be our guest today. Thanks for that. So it sounds like a very interesting and diverse role. How did you end up in meteorology as a career?
I guess I was always interested in the sky, even as a kid. I used to go taking pictures of clouds and things like that, and loved thunderstorms and was fascinated by them. So I studied meteorology in college, and I also began to understand how big a role and how big an issue climate change was. So that made me doubly interested in it as well. So my background is actually in climate research. I spent a few years in Canada for my PhD studying how glaciers were melting and what was causing their melt. And I found that really, really fascinating, really interesting. And then I've moved into more Earth observation roles since I've come back to work for Met Aaron. But it's been a lifelong passion and interest for me.
So you said about an interest in storms growing up. I guess this comes from living in Ireland. And I myself grew up in the southwest of the UK, so also relatively exposed to the Atlantic, where a lot of these big storms come from. Can you tell us a bit about the typical weather in Ireland and how these storms are part of it?
Of course. I guess if you were going to describe the weather in Ireland, dynamic is probably the best way to describe it. The old saying is we get four seasons in one day, but it really is true. It's very, very changeable. So where Ireland is positioned, we have a westerly flow. So kind of our weather comes in off the Atlantic. So it's very humid, it's very wet, it's very windy. And really Ireland is the first landmass in Europe that all this weather hits. So we tend to get the brunt of it. So it's a very, very maritime, very sort of oceanic climate. We've no major extremes. The ocean is a real moderator when it comes to weather. It keeps things kind of at a medium, really. We're also very close to what we call the polar front, where the jet stream is. So it means that we're sort of right on the boundary between hot and cold weather. So little fluctuations in that boundary means that our weather can change quite a bit. That location as well is also where you get a lot of these Atlantic storms tracking across from the west, when particularly during the winter. So Ireland is also often in the firing line for these storms. It's actually been quite a quiet winter this year, but in most years we have several named storms coming across the Atlantic, and we sort of sample them first before they hit the rest of Europe.
It's interesting you pick up on the naming. This was something I wanted to ask you about. So I think for a lot of people in the general public, one of the things that they first hear about with these storms that are coming is the names, and they can be quite funny, or they become the thing that's on, you know, people's tongues when they're talking over coffee each day. So how do you decide to name the storms, and what is the reasoning behind this? Why name them?
So I think even you've hit on it there about, you know, it's on people's tongues talking about coffee, the names of the storm. But I suppose to start off, we name the storms if we believe that they're going to cause sort of a medium or high level of impact to the public. So that equates to what we would call an orange or a red level warning for our weather warnings. The reasons we do it are sort of twofold. One is to increase public awareness. So as you say, if a storm has a name, it's on people's tongues. It's easy to communicate it. So we've seen much greater public awareness. If you can name a storm, it's much easier to publicize it in the media. It has an identity, and that allows maintaining a coherent message in warnings that we're talking about this singular event by giving the storm a name.
It sounds like a really effective way to proceed. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And then not just sort of with the public and with the media, but also it helps with coordination across weather services. So as you know, the weather doesn't keep to any borders or anything like that. So if a storm has occurred in one location, it's good that we can have coordination amongst different weather services in different countries where the storm may affect. So for example, we team up with the UK Met Office and KNMI, the Dutch Weather Service, in naming our storm. So when we're talking about a storm event, we're all using the same name, basically. And if any other European country names a storm before we do, we'll continue to use the name that they've given to it. So it means that one event has the same name. It helps in sharing information and giving a coherent message.
Yeah, it's a really clever sort of tool in communication, I think, to name them. And it's interesting for you to hear you say about the different organizations you work with, because I can almost imagine the storms passing past all those different Met offices across the continent. And then eventually we kind of get the tail end of them here in Darmstadt. So, you know, it's a complicated thing to monitor the weather, but also a complicated thing to communicate about it. So it's really cool how you guys use naming as a tool to help communicate to the general public. So taking a step back, still talking about storms, but I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier about the sea being this fantastic modulating influence on the weather. And so I'm an oceanographer, so I know a bit about the ocean, but I tend to think about it on much longer terms than maybe you folks do sort of on the weather side of things. But I know that the sea has an important role to play in terms of powering and influencing how these storms form. So how does satellite data, including that about the oceans, help you with weather forecasting in Ireland?
For sure. So as I mentioned, the weather in Ireland is very changeable. And really, the best way to view or track those changes is by having observations that are constantly looking at the weather and at these weather systems. And really, satellite data is the best mechanism for doing this. So it really allows us to track our rapidly changing weather. So our forecasters would use satellite data in a number of different ways. So the first would be looking at satellite imagery to analyze what the current condition is, so what the atmosphere is doing right now, and to get a sense of how the atmosphere is set up. Then they will also look at the satellite data and compare it with what our weather forecast models are showing. So we call our forecast models numerical weather prediction, kind of like the maths that we use to generate our forecast models that we use computers to run. So what our forecasters will do is they will look at what the forecast model is saying the atmosphere or the weather should look like. And then they will also look at what the satellite imagery is saying is actually happening. And by comparing the two, we can get a sense of how accurate our forecast model is performing. And then if you've a sense of how trustworthy it is, you might be able to say, well, this forecast, it's already a little bit off. In 12 hours time, it might not be that reliable. So it just gives the forecasters a sense of how well the model is performing in this particular situation. And then another way that our forecasters use satellite data is in what we call nowcasting. So as the name suggests, it's sort of forecasting for the now, or very, very short range, maybe 2 to 3 hours, something like that. And what our forecasters will do is they'll look at weather features in the satellite imagery, This is very useful for things like, say, maybe developing thunderstorms or heavy rain showers, things like that, or the front, like the edge of an arriving weather system. And they will be able to see from satellite imagery, if say they look at the last hour of satellite imagery, they'll be able to see how that storm or that weather feature is moving in time, and get a sense then that in the next 2 hours, if it's moving at that speed in that direction, it's going to hit this town in 2 hours' time, or it's going to be in this location, or maybe it's dying off, things like that. So that's now casting. So a range of ways that our forecasters use satellite data. And as I said, particularly where we are, where there's rapidly changing weather, it's very, very useful.
It strikes me as a really interesting mix of sort of data-driven technology, computational power behind this, but also still a huge amount of people and people's knowledge and interpretation to make these decisions. What do you think is going to change in the future? I mean, we've just launched a new satellite. What are you looking forward to in terms of the data that comes from that or other missions that are on the horizon?
Absolutely. I guess, as you say, that the new satellite that is launched, and we're looking forward to the whole string of new launches coming in the next few years. I think the most important thing for us initially, and I'm sure for many weather services, is actually the continuity of that data. So we've been using Meteosat data for over 40 years. And so many of our applications utilize this data, and then our downstream users rely on these, on these forecasts or these warnings, etc. So if we were to, if that data was to stop flowing in the morning, it would really be noticed. So the main thing, the most positive thing for us, is that this next generation of satellites is continuing this really useful data that we have. I think probably the most exciting thing and the most useful thing for us initially would say the new Meteosat satellites is going to be the increase in resolution, both the spatial, so like how finely we can see the imagery, and the temporal, so the frequency that we'll be getting these images. We'll be getting them more regularly than we do currently. That will be very useful to our forecasters, again, particularly for tracking very rapidly developing weather, or also if we want to see fine, small features like things like fog development, for example, if fog is developing in certain valleys, things like that, this high resolution will allow us to detect that. That'll be very useful for us. We don't just use satellite data for forecasting. As I mentioned, we numerical weather prediction, so weather models and weather forecasting is also something that we do, and we use satellite data in our weather models. Basically, satellite data allows us in part to get an idea of what the atmosphere is like right now, and then we'll use our weather model to advance that into the future to see what the forecast is going to be. So we use lots of different data, but there's a new source of data that will be on the MTG Sounder satellite, which is an infrared sounder, and this will give us temperature and humidity profiles up through the depth of the atmosphere, amongst other data, but this will be particularly of interest to us. This is the first time this data will be available from what we call a geostationary platform, so a satellite that is constantly looking at the same part of the Earth all the time. And we'll be able to get these temperature and humidity profiles very regularly from this satellite, and that will be very useful for numerical weather prediction. And as I said, it's the first time that will be available from this geostationary platform. So from a satellite that will be looking at our area all the time. So that's something that we're quite excited to see the data and get working with.
Fantastic. So we've spoken a bit there about the new geostationary missions, the MTG generation of satellites. We've got one launched last year. We've got more coming in the future. But we also have another generation of our other satellites, so the METOP second generation, coming soon. Now, these are polar orbiting satellites, so rather than sitting in one place looking at the same patch of Earth, they orbit around over our poles. From the perspective of a Met agency and of weather forecasting, what does these two different styles of satellite, what do they bring to the forecasting system for you?
Yeah, so the geostationary platforms that we mentioned, so Meteosat, things like that, the benefit of them is they're constantly looking at the same area all the time. So that means they're very good for monitoring rapid changes, because you're always looking at the same area, you're getting frequent imagery from them. But they're also quite high up above the Earth. So the Meteosat satellites are about 36,000 kilometers or
Yeah,
so
something
above
like
Earth. Yeah.
that.
So it means that the imagery is it's very good, but it is taken from quite a distance away. So the polar orbiting satellites, they orbit around Earth from pole to pole, but they're much closer. They're around, say, 800 kilometers, something like that, maybe less, above Earth. So they're much closer, which means they can get finer, sort of high resolution data and observations of the Earth. Maybe the trade-off then is because they're orbiting sort of pole to pole, they're not constantly looking at the same space all the time because the Earth is also rotating underneath them. So you might, of any one given sort of polar orbiting satellite, it might only pass over your area of interest once or twice a day or something like that. So they both have their positives and negatives. But focusing on those polar orbiting satellites, so at present we use data from polar orbiting satellites like MetOp in our numerical weather prediction. So, as I mentioned, one thing that's very useful for us are soundings. So profiles of temperature and humidity through the atmosphere. That will be very useful with the next generation of MetOp satellites as well. We want to maintain that. And also we use what we call scatterometer data, which is data that tells us things like wind speeds over the ocean or wave heights, things like that. So with the next generation of MetOp SG being launched, this will be very important to us because we ourselves are starting a new sort of numerical weather prediction collaboration. So it's a new forecast model collaboration. We're doing this with it's ourselves, the Dutch Weather Service, KNMI, with Denmark and with Iceland. And we're building a forecast model that will cover the areas of interest that those countries are interested in. And we're going to build a high performance computing system, which we will house in Iceland, that will run this weather model. The data that will come from MetOp SG will be very important for running that model. So we will be pulling it directly into our high performance computer in Iceland. And that will be a very important component, as I mentioned, of telling our forecast model what the atmosphere is like in reality before it starts to generate its forecast.
One of the things that really seems to strike me now about the Earth observation sort of ecosystem, or the satellites, the programs, the way we're approaching understanding our planet around topics like weather, around climate change, is that it's really not a siloed thing anymore. You can hear from what you were saying all about how you work with these different organizations, about how weather doesn't respect, our boundaries, but you can also see it in the way that the satellite programs are designed now. So I mean, you mentioned things like significant wave height, and in my head, these are things that we use in the oceanographic world that are also then used in the meteorological world. And I think the missions themselves are being designed now more and more, and the programs are being designed more and more to cover all these different aspects of our Earth system. And I guess, I mean, for me, that's how I ended up here at UMetSat as an ocean scientist. And, I have colleagues who are atmospheric chemists, people who work on, the land and understand things like drought and ice and all sorts of different parts of the Earth system. So really, we are starting to have this perspective, and the satellites reflect that. So I wanted to ask you a bit about how this is impacting your organization sort of now and in the future. We talked about the MetOp SG satellites and the MTG generation as well. And as well as being weather satellites, these will also have what we call Copernicus missions on. So Sentinel-4 and Sentinel-5 missions, which will have a strong air quality component. Will your organization be using this data as well as data from sort of the weather side of those missions too?
Yes, of course. And just to go back to what you're saying, it's a really good point. I mean, even the atmosphere, it interacts with all of these other systems on Earth, and it's this more sort of whole system approach that people are taking, not just in terms of how these organizations work and the people that work in them, but even how we design the models that we use to predict them. We're accounting for a lot more processes, not just in the atmosphere, but in all these other atmosphere, ocean and land and ice processes that are taking place as well. We certainly do use other data. So you mentioned there the Sentinel missions. So that will be of interest to us. We run air quality measurements in Ireland. The measurements that we take actually on the west coast of Ireland are of particular importance because we've such a what we call a clear sector. So as our airflow is coming from the west, it's coming off the ocean, and our sensors on the west coast, particularly at Valentia on the west coast of Ireland, are the first to sample this air. And it's generally like what we might call clean air, because it's not coming from populated or industrialized regions. It's coming off the ocean. So it's a good reference point for what maybe a clean air quality might be. And we also have other air quality observations through the country and in cities and urban areas. But the Sentinel-4 data, which will be on the MTG satellite, will be very useful for us in comparing with these measurements and in giving us a more denser network of those observations, more dense than we would be able to have with on-the-ground measurements. And we also feel like we may be able to sort of feed back into that mission as well, because, as I mentioned, we have good quality on-the-ground air quality measurements. They could be used for sort of ground-truthing the observations that the satellites are taking. So helping to sort of validate that the satellite is recording what we think it is by comparing it with on-the-ground observations as well. And then more broadly, we use Copernicus data in our organization quite a bit. Some of the more sort of straightforward ways, we use the graphics and analysis that Copernicus produces in things like its, say, State of the Climate report. We use that for internal and public bulletins and information points about climate change, etc. Copernicus has a ensemble forecast system. So the Copernicus Climate Change Service has an ensemble forecast system. And by ensemble, I mean basically that you're running a forecast multiple times to see what the outcome will be and if they're all in agreement, essentially. We use that when we are generating our own seasonal forecasts for Ireland. We use that along with some other models as well. And that's a very useful feature from Copernicus. Our hydrometeorologists use quite a bit of Copernicus data. So by hydrometeorologists, I mean our meteorologists who are interested in things like rainfall and flooding. So there is a Copernicus European Flood Awareness System. So our hydrometeorologists would consult that on a daily or sub-daily basis, and it gives forecasts and alerts on potential flood risk to people who are most interested in that. So not just, you know, to us, and then we pass that on to local authorities who might be controlling flood defences and things like that. We also consult Copernicus drought monitoring services from time to time, although in Ireland it's not quite as big an issue as you could imagine. And then when we do have a flood event, Copernicus has a service called the Rapid Mapping Service. So this is very useful. It gives satellite imagery of flood extent. So we would consult that imagery as an event is taking place, and also after an event, to kind of learn about what happened, what the impacts were, and maybe to help give warnings for future events as well.
It's really amazing to me to hear all these different ways that this system comes together to benefit people downstream. You know, we hear a lot about the satellites in this building. You know, that's our, you know, every day is operating them. We hear a lot about the programs, but to hear how all that actually translates with the combination of knowledge from these colleagues with very different backgrounds to an impact such as, you know, checking what happened with regards to flooding and how we can adapt to that under climate change really shows how, you know, we could go from this crazy amount of sort of technical space, like infrastructure, down to changing lives on the ground. So that's fantastic to hear, Noel. Thanks for sharing that example. I wanted to move on to maybe something a bit more futuristic even than our upcoming missions or sort of forecast was the topic of AI. So artificial intelligence and machine learning, it's really a word that's buzzing around at the moment. It's, you know, really having its day in the sun, if you like, AI and things at the moment. Everybody's interested in, can we use AI for this? So from your perspective, how do you think AI machine learning approaches will impact our ability to forecast the weather in the future?
Yeah, as you say, it's AI is everywhere at the moment.
It's unavoidable.
Yeah, exactly. And it is even in the present starting to be used in meteorology and weather forecasting. And certainly, I feel will have a bigger impact going into the future. How it will be used, it can be used or could be used in many different stages of weather forecasting and meteorology. So initially, and this is somewhere that's actually already starting to be used, is in the quality control of observations. So As I mentioned, we take in lots of observations for running our computer models, our weather models. And the more data, generally, you know, try and get as many data sources and over as many locations as possible. There are attempts to look at how we can use AI to quality control that data. And that's really important, because if you want your model to perform well, you want to make sure that the information you're feeding it is accurate. Because if you have even very small changes or very small inaccuracies in your observations, can lead to a wildly wrong forecast when you give it enough time, due to this, what we call the sort of the chaotic nature of our atmosphere. Small changes can lead to big changes down the line. So it's very important you have accurate observations. AI can help with the quality control of those. This will be particularly a feature if you want to start using observations that aren't coming from sort of traditional sources. So traditional sources might be things like your surface weather stations or satellites or radar, things like that. Say you wanted to start using observations from sensors that you have in your smart technology. So sensors that you might have on your phone or on your car or maybe in appliances, things like that measure temperature or pressure. It would be very useful to be able to use this data, but we can't be sure of how good the quality is. So AI may be used in the future to quality control that data. Once you have the data then in the building, so to speak, we would feed it into our model. We call that data assimilation, where we take it in and put it into our model. AI may be used to help us select which data is the most useful to use in our model. Because we want our forecast models to be efficient, we want them to run quickly so that they're so that we can have regular updates to the forecast and that they're available on time. So we want to make sure we're also pulling in the most useful data. So AI may be used to select what data we take into our model, rather than just shoving everything into the model. We can sort of be a little bit more clever and just use the data that gives us the best model performance. So that's something that AI could help with as well. Then more broadly, it's possible AI could change how we model the weather in the first place. So at the moment, we use a physics-based model. So essentially, we try and understand the physics that control the movements and processes in the atmosphere. We sort of replicate that through physics and equations in our computer models, and we use those to generate a forecast. AI models may behave differently, or they may work differently. What they may do is they'll look at decades of weather observations and weather outcomes, so what the weather actually did, and it will use all that information to learn how does the atmosphere respond for a given set of conditions and generate a forecast from that. So it's possible in the future we will have AI weather models, and we may not know how exactly they work. You know, AI can be, this has this sort of middle section where it's sort of a black box and we don't fully understand what's happening, but it will be learning based on previous data. So that is a possibility. Now, one sort of caveat with that is we are in a period of climate change where our atmosphere is changing rapidly. So past examples and past patterns may not hold up in the future. So it's possible that AI will need to account for that. But that's another possible direction that AI could go. And then finally, when we have our forecast and we have our output from these forecast models, AI may be used to help identify features or regions of interest that perhaps a forecaster may not have spotted yet. So say, for example, maybe an area where there could be potential thunderstorm development later that day. There might be the right conditions, but it's not really evident yet, but an AI system might be able to detect a region where, oh, okay, the conditions are ripe there for something like that developing. Another thing might be in Ireland, for example, when we get these big storms coming off the Atlantic, there can sometimes be a feature called a sting jet, which is kind of an area of intense wind that occur at the back of these storms. It's a narrow, intense area of winds, and they can do damage when they occur. So AI could be used to detect when these areas, these features are developing, and just give forecasters a bit more of a heads up or a bit more lead time to give warnings to this. So it's really widespread where it could be used. Obviously, that's just a selection of ideas. I think what's going to be interesting is just seeing the scope of where AI could help. But there are many different possibilities.
Yeah, it really seems to me like we're stepping into this kind of period of, how do they call it, like unknown unknowns. We don't really know what's going to happen. We've got so much to explore in terms of how these new technologies could benefit not just weather forecasting, but, you know, Earth system observation and monitoring and modeling more broadly. So I was just thinking about it when you were saying there about, you know, how it can help improve accuracy and things like that, and reflecting on, if we think about what's going to happen in the future from now, let's look back and see, well, how did things change in the past? And from speaking to colleagues around here, you know, I hear about how much the weather forecast has improved in terms of accuracy and things like that in recent years. And, you know, since we really started monitoring and modeling the world as we do now. And I can't imagine back, you know, 50, 100 years ago, we really knew that we were going to be in this situation now. So maybe we don't know where we're going to be in 50 to 100 years, but I'm going to ask you anyway, where do you think that forecasting is going now? I mean, how accurate do you think we can get it? What do you think will be the major things that help us to improve in the future? Maybe AI is one of them.
For sure. So I certainly think AI will play a major role for all the reasons that I just mentioned. Also, I think access to a denser network of observations. So as I kind of mentioned already, I think utilizing smart devices and the observations that they make and allowing that to have a much denser network of observations will also be a big benefit going forward, because I mean, I think everything is becoming a smart object now, from, as I said, from your car to the various, to your fridge, to whatever else in your house, to your doorbell. So it's possible that information could be utilized again to give us more observations. I think that using these various, as I said, increases in observations, higher resolution satellite data, and AI, I think our short-term forecasts will become more accurate. So in other words, maybe, you know, a week or so, we will be able to be more specific on location and timing of weather events. And that will be very useful to the general public and to users who need it for, you know, their operations, etc. I think there is an upper limit, though, because of what is the chaotic nature of the atmosphere. So I know I mentioned this already, but in our atmosphere, very small changes can result in very big changes down the line. There's so many degrees of freedom. And there's so many things that you can change in the atmosphere. So many processes taking place, too many to account for. If you think about, the atmosphere stretches over our whole globe and extends upwards as well for 100 kilometers or so. Any small changes in all the processes that are taking place in that space can result in a very different outcome in our forecast. So I think how far out we can forecast is going to be limited by that process. I think sort of theoretically the maximum is maybe 2 weeks, something like that, for precise short-term forecasts. However, things like seasonal forecasting, I believe, will improve as well. So seasonal forecasting, where we're not necessarily saying what the weather is going to be like on the afternoon of June 5th in your back garden, say, but we might be able to say that week in June is going to be warmer than average, cooler than average, more rainfall than average, etc., and be able to say that with a greater certainty. So that'd be very useful for people managing our energy systems, for people producing food, people planning outdoor events, things like that. So I think we're going to see an improvement. I think, as you mentioned, we have had a rapid improvement in performance, particularly in the last 30 years or so or less. But there is a limit to that, and that's governed by how chaotic the atmosphere is. Now, maybe AI will discover something that we haven't discovered yet and provide us a solution to that. But my feeling on it is that there is an upper limit to how far we can forecast into the future with accuracy.
I think that's a really pragmatic way of looking at it. We have so much that we can do, so much we still need to do. But I just imagine that the Earth system, whenever I've sort of tried to do research in it, is quite a humbling thing in its complexity and its chaotic nature. So yeah, it's good to know that there's probably still some unknown unknowns out there for us to sort of bash our research minds up against and see what we can do to learn more about our planet in the future. But one thing's for sure, I think we certainly have the right expertise in organizations like yours. And from the UBETSAT's part, we'll be doing our best to bring the data you need to address these challenges. So with that, I'd like to say thank you very much, Junal, for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear about the work that's going on at BetErin. And I hope we'll hear from you again as the satellites are launched and you start using the data more in future. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed the chat. Thanks for having me on.